Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Good afternoon. Welcome to today's webinar on the subject of the R2V3 standard, lessons learned, and common NCRs. My name is Austin Matthews. I am the EHS Program Manager with Perry Johnson Registrars. Welcome. I have a brief agenda on this first slide. We'll cover some housekeeping items, talk a little bit about PJR, who we are, what we do, highlight the benefits of certification to R2V3, and then we'll get into the bulk of the presentation, which includes a discussion of common NCRs and some lessons learned through our experiences thus far with R2V3 as a certification body. We will close with an overview of the certification process for anyone who is pursuing initial certification in the near future rather than a transition audit necessarily. Just very briefly, the benefits of certification for a standard covering electronics recycling like R2V3 include, of course, that commitment to responsibly reusing and recycling electronics, to be able to advertise that commitment. The certification process maintaining, implementing the standard also drives improvement in an organization's environmental health and safety performance by fulfilling the requirements of the standard itself. The standard also represents a framework for meeting customer and/or regulatory requirements, again, by going through the process of implementing those requirements. It also drives improvement in a number of other areas, including management commitment and employee engagement levels. Being able to advertise a certification like R2 can provide a competitive advantage over competitors who may not hold that same certification. And again, going hand in hand with being able to advertise that commitment to recycling along with the competitive advantage the certification itself can provide, both of those can lead to improvements to an organization's public image, potentially standing out as a more sustainable organization or a company that prioritizes data security or sustainability, again, compared to local competitors. If it provides a competitive advantage and you're able to win bids that you would not otherwise have won, that can be a potential financial benefit as well. In some areas, some types of insurance will offer a lower premium for companies who hold a given certification. We find this is more common on the health and safety side, but it's always worth inquiring about. Implementing and maintaining the requirements of the standard can also help achieve strategic business objectives that the organization may have, as well as meet stakeholder requirements if there are any that apply. The standard is able to be integrated with other business management systems as well. As a certification body, PJR is required to track and report our NCR trends to SERI. This is something that they require on a monthly basis and monitor for trends. So I developed this webinar and confirm with the data that we're reporting as far as our NCRs and our NCR tracking and update these slides if there are any changing trends in the areas in which we see the majority of NCRs identified. These aren't in any particular order, so far these slides haven't changed very much, but I will continue to keep those updated. I expect that as we see more audits taking place, just initial transition, but maybe the subsequent surveillance or two, we'll see shifts in the trends or the most common NCRs. And these slides will be updated more drastically. So again, in no particular order, we see a number of NCRs written against Appendix A, B, and C, and we'll cover some other requirements on the subsequent slides. Some examples of the findings we commonly see written against Appendix A might include incomplete due diligence records, especially given the differences between R2-2013 and R2-V3, if the Tier 1 downstream vendors are not R2-V3 certified. We see incorrect identification of downstream vendors as R2-V3 downstream vendors when really perhaps they are still only certified to R2-2013, or worse yet, are not R2 certified at all. Again, if they are not R2-V3, if they're R2-2013 or non-R2-V3 or I'm sorry, non-R2 at all, they have to have due diligence performed against Appendix A in quite a bit more detail than the R2-V3 Tier 1 downstream vendors are required. We also see findings against the verification expectations for downstream vendors to meet relevant appendix requirements. For example, if a downstream vendor is responsible for data sanitization, maybe logical or physical, there are additional expectations for the downstream due diligence explained in Appendix A. That seems to be commonly overlooked, or perhaps an organization isn't making the connection between the initial expectations for due diligence and then those additional requirements where other appendices may come into play. So it's really important to take a step back and look at the bigger picture for companies not fulfilling certain appendices. If their downstream vendors are fulfilling those, that's part of the due diligence expectations in Appendix A, especially if they're not R2-V3 certified. The other common finding we see written against Appendix A would be in regards to the pollution liability insurance expectations for organizations that process negative value equipment. And this can look several different ways, including an organization thinking they don't process negative value equipment when they do, and thus not holding pollution liability insurance. It could also be a lack of evidence to support their claim of not processing negative value equipment, and again, necessitating pollution liability insurance. Common findings written against Appendix B are numerous in nature. So to really simplify it into two categories, it would be having inadequacies within the process for conducting data sanitization, or not implementing all of the applicable requirements. So whether the documentation of the process is insufficient or the process's implementation is insufficient, we do see a significant number of findings against Appendix B for organizations that qualify for Appendix B, or perhaps they haven't totally fleshed out who meets those expectations within their recycling chain and haven't accounted for that adequately to ensure that even the core requirements are met. Some examples of the findings we see with Appendix B may relate to the software, the types of software being utilized for sanitization, or in fact, a lack of software. We've seen a high number of NCRs written regarding manual or factory resets in lieu of using software as required. There are requirements to maintain video recordings. There are prescribed acceptable destruction methodologies. There are requirements for utilizing unique identifiers. There are very specific requirements for what needs to be included in a data sanitization plan. There are also training and competency requirements. Those are some common areas against which Appendix B findings are written by PJR. PJR auditors, I should say. Similar to Appendix B, Appendix C does have quite a few requirements within it. So to overgeneralize, we could see insufficient processes or insufficient documentation or procedures as far as Appendix B, C findings go. Some examples might be not maintaining individualized records. Again, we go back to that unique identifier concept in Appendix B. We're looking for records to correlate each individual item and each item's functionality when we're doing that testing. Software requirements are also found in Appendix C. That's a common source of NCR. We need to account for all relevant media types. That's another relevant type of NCR. If you are accepting a wide variety of electronics but have only outlined the testing protocols for a subset of those, that could be an issue with Appendix C. There are also prescribed criteria to be included in the reuse plan, which can possibly lead to Appendix C findings. Findings in the remaining appendices are less common than those first three, so I don't necessarily cover them in this particular webinar. Again, not in any particular order as far as the number of NCRs, but rather going chronologically, we go next to the core requirements. Common NCRs against core requirement one might include missing relevant names under which you do business that should be included within the certification, or having DBAs used as DBAs without that formal DBA registration. So maybe it's not a legal entity name as it needs to be. The schemes identified in the code of practice affect scope, audit time, and a number of other factors. So ensuring that the correct scheme is applied is very important. Excuse me. And the code of practice also specifies the verbiage that is permitted within a scope, and it directly correlates to the appendices that an organization qualifies for. So there really is no room for revising the scope statement or tweaking the verbiage. It needs to accurately reflect the appendices being certified and the types of electronics being audited and processed at the facility. So scoping is very important too. A common NCR against Core 3 is covering the risk assessment and exposure evaluation requirement. So this likely goes above and beyond what ISO 14001 may require or what you may already have had documented for R2 2013. This is a common NCR for Core 3. Common NCR against Core Requirement 5 would be incomplete or insufficient transaction summaries. Perhaps not all inbound and outbound transactions are accounted for. Perhaps they're accounted for, but not to the level of detail expected in R2v3. Perhaps you're still getting your arms around a process to account for all the transactions. That's a common source of NCR for Core Requirement 5. Core Requirement 6 is a very common source of NCR in and of itself. There are a whole host of requirements in Core 6, and it's really the bulk of the processing expectations in the standard. So again, to oversimplify, we could see insufficient processes, but we could also see incomplete documentation or procedures. So some examples that I've seen often include the categorization appropriateness, the availability and adequacy of the test records for each item and functionality, the sorting process to ensure subsequent processing meets the expectations. How is the material identified for further processing to ensure that all of Core 6 is being adhered to? And that could include consideration of what's coming through the door, what has the upstream done, if there's testing or data sanitization supposedly already taking place. Core 6 also houses the expectations for obtaining records or sampling to corroborate that information that's coming with the material or the condition in which the material is supposedly in. Incorporating or adhering to the REC is another common source of NCR. You can use the grading and categorization in the REC, or you can have a cross-reference, but you do need to fulfill one of those two requirements to be able to demonstrate that the REC is incorporated into the R2v3 system. And that's something that we sample during our audits. Is the process for grading in alignment with the REC, again, whether it's a cross-reference or using those exact categories? And then, do those outputs make sense? Are we seeing functionality and cosmetic codes that make sense given the condition of the equipment being sampled and the test records that are being maintained with the equipment? There are some sampling requirements as well, as I mentioned earlier. That can be a source of NCR if the sampling is inadequate, ineffective, or overlooked. Common NCRs against Core 7, again, a whole host of data sanitization and security expectations. So we could see incomplete processes, we could see incomplete documentation or procedures. Some examples include insufficient data sanitization plans, data security plans, missing prescribed items, training protocols not met, inadequate controls for pre-sanitized media, missing acknowledgments for those with specific security clearances. Is the security adequate within the facility? Is material controlled when it's received and throughout processing until it's sanitized, or through transport if the sanitization is not completed on site? The appropriateness or the completeness of those independent audit requirements. Those are some common NCRs against Core Requirement 7. Core Requirement 9, we commonly see insufficient closure plans. Perhaps some of the prescribed requirements are not accounted for within the documented plan. We also see insufficient financial instruments. That could be that the documentation of the financial instrument doesn't meet the expectations, or that the financial instrument itself does not meet the requirements. We have reference material guidance from even the R2 2013 version of the standard that we still see clients receiving NCRs for. For example, using assets to cover the financial instrument is not acceptable under R2v3, just like it was not under R2 2013. A checking account in and of itself also would not suffice. So this is a common source of NCRs still with R2v3. We also see insufficiencies with insurance coverage sometimes. So I've included that here. This could include pollution liability insurance, which we talked a little bit about in Appendix A. It could be inclusive of workers' comp if you don't have a number, a certain number of employees. The standard is requiring, even if you are not doing a formal workers' comp insurance, that you have reserves in place. So that's something that you want to take a look at as well in Core Requirement 9. Those are some of the most common NCR core requirements and appendices, overgeneralized so that we can cover it all within the allotted time. Certainly, as I mentioned earlier, the CRE website and the knowledge base, they do focus on certain areas as they're seeing trends as well. You may see interviews, you may see additional training come out, you may see formal interpretations, different material, and they're monitoring those trends as well. So you can tune back into future webinars as we maintain these slides, but you can also utilize the CRE website as a reference tool. Switching gears from the common NCRs, I also want to cover some of the lessons learned over the last almost 2 years of auditing to R2v3 now. One of the biggest learning curves, or one of the most important elements, are the appendices, identifying the correct appendices. We don't want to be missing any, but we also don't want to include any that are irrelevant. The appendices have a significant impact on a number of things: the audit trails, the scope statement on the certificate, the audit time, especially when there is more than one facility. The further off we are on the appendices, or the less we understand the processes to determine the appendices, the more significantly audit time could be insufficient potentially. We certainly don't want to have longer audits than necessary and penalize the client with that expense, but we do need to make sure on the other side of that coin that we have enough time to audit all the requirements to which the client is subject. So identifying those appendices is definitely important. We're going to talk a little bit about the contract validation process. It's something that we endeavor to dig into through the contract validation, and then again gets confirmed during every audit. If you have any concerns about your appendices, definitely discuss that with your auditor. You can take a look at some of the resources on the CRE website, the knowledge base, that help guide clients as to what appendices may apply to them as well. It will come down to some fine points about how material is being processed, the types of equipment being used, the processing methodologies, the types of equipment, whether it's for reuse or recycling, for example. So there's a number of variables there, but determining the correct and most appropriate appendices is very important. So we continue to work to do that as accurately as possible. Another lesson learned for a number of clients is one of the key changes with R2v3 is the requirement for some clients to maintain a certified QMS, or a quality management system, whereas prior to R2v3 being published, the requirements were limited to EHS, environmental health and safety. So with the publication of R2v3 came the additional requirement for a certified quality management system for some clients. It is based on the appendices. So if you are certifying to Appendix C, D, and or F, you also need a certified QMS. And this was a little bit of a shock to some of our transitioning clients, if they were stage one and two clients. If it was earlier in the transition period, a bit of a scramble for them, perhaps, if they were not already familiar with that requirement or aware of that requirement, to go ahead and get that added. So I like to include it in all the webinar slides for anyone who hasn't already caught that piece of information. We talked already about scoping as far as appendix appropriateness and the prescriptive nature of the verbiage. So again, just to reiterate, the RTV3 code of practice is what dictates the scope verbiage. And if you take a look at the code of practice, which you can download through SERI's website, you'll actually find a table which correlates one for one the different types of appendices and the portions in which the client is being certified to the exact verbiage that's required to go in the scope. And then the second half of the scope would be specifying the types of electronics that the client processes. So it's very prescriptive. We don't get to decide what we want it to say as long as it's not misleading and accurate like we could with R2-2013. For your other certifications, obviously the RTV3 Code of Practices can't dictate the scope statements for other standard certificates. So if you would like to keep your, for example, ISO 14001 scope the same or similar to what it was before, as long as it's accurate and not misleading or excluding things that need to be included, then that would be fine. There's no requirement that the R2V3 scope be used for your other standard certifications as well. R2V3 introduces, again, via the Code of Practices, as well as Advisory 22, some changes to NCR closure deadlines and expectations. R2V3 requires a revisit for all NCRs written against the R2V3 standard. It's no longer up to the auditor's discretion. Those revisits can be virtual if the client's a good candidate and the findings don't explicitly need to be verified on site, in which case the revisit could be on site. The revisit is due within 90 days of the audit, as well as corrective action implementation. But even sooner than that, at the 60-day mark, is required the correction implementation evidence and just that overall response to the NCR, the correction, the root cause, the extent analysis, and the corrective action plans. You know, what you plan to do to close the finding, that's also due within 60 days, a tighter time frame than perhaps was previously required, and the results for the ramifications for not adhering to those deadlines are pretty stringent. They include suspension, in some cases withdrawal, and in other cases the need to repeat the audit, such as repeating the stage two. So we definitely want to make you aware of those sooner rather than later to avoid those particular ramifications. I mentioned towards the beginning of the presentation that facility schemes are also important. They affect the certificate structure, they affect the calculation of audit time. So as you prepare to transition, or as you prepare your registration process and you're filling out some of our documentation to apply for certification, it'll be really important to accurately relay the relationship that the organization may have with other locations, with other recyclers in the building, if there are any. The more accurate and transparent that information is, the more accurately we can identify the scheme and the audit time to not risk having a big issue on the back end when we are trying to issue the certificate and find it was categorized incorrectly based on information that was withheld. Another lesson learned along the way has been the world of virtual auditing, and that could warrant its own separate long webinar, but just in general, SERI and R2V3 have prescribed criteria or expectations for certain types of audits if they are permitted to be conducted virtually. There are advisories published for the different types of audits, and they memorialize the expectations for those audits to be eligible to be conducted virtually. There are requirements such as sharing of electronic documents by a specific deadline in advance of the audit to ensure that the client is able to support a successful virtual audit. It is a privilege not granted necessarily to all organizations. So in an effort to be able to continue to offer virtual audits, it is critical for PJR to adhere to those virtual audit advisories and expectations outlined by R2V3 so that some audits are still able to be conducted virtually. Those are available on CERI's website as well. If you're not familiar with those expectations, I encourage you to become familiar with them. And as PJR determines an audit is eligible for virtual auditing on a case-by-case basis, you'll also see those details communicated as part of the formal virtual approval when either the client or the auditor or both has requested that an audit be conducted virtually. And just to mention one more time, the CERI website and its knowledge base contain a lot of important and timely information. I encourage you not only to review it once, but to keep an eye on it as they may revise information on there or share new content as well. Before we get to any questions, just a quick review of the certification process for anyone pursuing initial certification, which again does differ from clients transitioning from R2 2013 to R2 V3. The first step when pursuing certification to a new standard is always to get a hold of the copy of the standard so you know what requirements you're being held to. You will then implement the requirements of the standard, conduct any training that is required, implement those requirements, so not just establishing the documentation, but actually doing what the standard and your procedures say you will do, including conducting an internal audit, conducting a compliance evaluation, and conducting a management review. You'll need a contract with a certification body to conduct your audits, and you'll be required to submit any pre-qualification information required. In this particular case with R2V3, I'm referring to the contract validation process, which fulfills the contract review expectations in the code of practice. Subsequent to that approval, you will conduct your stage one and your stage two audits, address any resulting nonconformities from either of those audits before a certificate can be issued. That is an oversimplification of the process, but for initial certification, you do have both the stage one and the stage two to complete and resolve any NCRs. The contract validation activity I mentioned on the last slide is an off-site activity. It's a high-level review to confirm readiness for R2V3, fulfill requirements spelled out in the code of practice for a number of different audit types, including stage ones, transitions, and transfers, and those are a quarter day to a half day in duration. Stage one audits primarily focus on documentation and evaluate an organization's readiness for their stage two. NCRs can be identified during an R2V3 stage one and do need to be resolved before the stage two can even take place. The stage two audit is a full system audit covering all of the applicable requirements. And again, any NCRs that are identified do need to be resolved before the process can continue. R2V3 requirements in the code of practice dictate that the stage two time for R2V3 does need to be conducted on site. Those are not eligible for virtual audits. Surveillance audits, once the Stage two, NCRs are closed, the package is reviewed by a technical committee, and the certificate issued. The surveillance cycles are the following 2 years, and audits could be semi-annual or annual in nature, depending on the contract. Those represent partial system audits, not as lengthy necessarily as the stage two, and we're able to sample the requirements versus covering all of them like that initial registration process would do. The third year of the cycle represents the recertification audit, which is very similar to the stage two. It's a full system audit, and any NCRs need to be resolved before a certificate could be issued, restarting the three-year cycle again. If you haven't already done so, please feel free to type out any questions that you may have. And in the meantime, I am going to put my contact information up in case there is a more technical or a client-specific question that would be better discussed outside of the webinar format. Again, my name is Austin Matthews. I'm the EHS Program Manager at PJR. I can be reached through the main PJR line or via email. They can put you through to my extension, or you can send me an email. I've also included the sales department phone number here. If you are a new client looking for a quote, looking for information about registration, that would be a great place to start. Let's see what questions we have. We have a question about stage one and stage two guidance. A contract in which AS9100 certification is a requirement. So I'm not sure if your question is related to the R2V3 stage one and stage two expectations, or if you're asking specifically about the AS9100 stage one and stage two expectations. If you're asking the latter, I'm not a good person to answer that question. My focus is specific to EHS and sustainability. So I would recommend for AS9100 information reaching out to the sales department, since we do have folks that can help with any of those standards. And if you're asking about R2V3 stage one and stage two guidance, the Siri Knowledge Base website has information about preparing for your audit. I don't recall if it's specifically a checklist format, but they do have audit preparation information on their website. I don't know that we specifically have an R2V3 stage one and stage two guidance document, but my contact information is listed on this slide as well. If you want to send me an email with a more specific question or rephrase it while I'm still on the line, I'll do my best to try and answer that. See if there are any other questions. I'll stay on another moment or two in case anyone is typing. In the meantime, just to reiterate, the training is being recorded. Copies of the recording and of the slides will be made available on PJR's website, and we will continue to keep the slide content updated as trends change. So feel free to tune back into a future webinar on this topic or check out some of the other topic webinars that we do provide each month. I don't think any other questions are coming through on my end. So thank you so much for joining me today. Feel free to tune back into a future webinar. And if you have an R2V3 audit coming up, I hope the content was helpful. Best of luck during your audit.